Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
So a place where there aren't actually farmers present, but they are able to sell their food, might be a good thing for the farmers.
Jennifer Mita Robinson continues our conversation about how farmers markets are changing. She suggests that sometimes we can feel more of a local connection to growers halfway around the world than to those in our backyards. Farmers are preparing for what they fear could be an even more devastating bird flu outbreak this fall. Harvest Public Media also gives us a snapshot of the Missouri State Farm and two recipes for fall with Chef Daniel Orr. Go ahead and add apples and acorn squash to your market list. Ground beef, burritos, and pizza. That's on the menu for Mark Chilla and our news update.
Most hamburger meat is contaminated with bacteria, and a lot of those bugs have superpowers. That's the conclusion of a new study from Consumer Reports, which found that out of 300 samples from stores across the country, bacteria linked to fecal contamination was detected in nearly every package. Researchers found that 18% of ground beef from conventionally raised cows that are fed antibiotics contained E. coli and other bacteria resistant to three or more classes of antibiotics used in human medicine. Organic grass-fed beef raised without antibiotics scored better, with just 9% containing antibiotic-resistant bacteria. The report recommends buying sustainably raised beef when possible. Critics from the meat industry said the findings about superbugs was misleading and alarmist because resistant bacteria detected rarely cause foodborne illness. Food safety advocates recommend cooking beef of all kinds at a temperature of 160 degrees Fahrenheit to kill off bacteria. Back in April, Chipotle announced it would stop serving GMOs. A new class action lawsuit says the burrito chain's marketing claims are misleading. The complaint lists the foods on Chipotle menus that still contain GMOs. Meat, cheese, and sour cream come from animals that are fed GMOs. And of course, its sodas contain syrup from genetically modified corn. It adds that the chain has not taken meaningful steps to clarify consumer misconceptions. A spokesperson for Chipotle told NPR that the restaurant will, quote, vigorously contest this meritless and unfair claim, unquote. If you scroll to the bottom of the website, chipotle.com/GMO, you'll see a paragraph that addresses the question of GMOs in animal feed and soda. Some Midwest farmers are cheering a legal ruling from last week that delays new water pollution rules from the Environmental Protection Agency, but only in some states. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted has the story.
The rules give the EPA power to regulate some streams and tributaries under the Clean Water Act. A federal judge issued an injunction which will put the rules on pause in 13 states, including Colorado, Missouri, Nebraska, and North and South Dakota. Those states are suing the agency over the regulations. The EPA says it will enforce the new rules everywhere else. Many farmers and ranchers have maligned the rules for granting additional authority to the EPA. Here's Blake Hurst, president of the Missouri Farm Bureau.
And, of course, there's tremendous concern from contractors, from farmers, from county road districts, from cities, from municipalities, tremendous concern about what the rule means to them.
The EPA maintains the regulations are critical for the agency to protect downstream waters from pollution. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
And some big food companies suddenly seem to be on board with healthier school lunches. The reason? There are big profits to be had with whole grain cinnamon rolls and reduced fat Doritos. As Politico reported this week, Schwann's invested heavily in reformulating its pizzas to meet USDA standards and still make them appealing to kids. Schwann's provides as much as 70% of the pizzas served in K-12 schools around the country. This conversation is happening as Congress prepares to vote to re-up the school food requirements. Gary Vonk, vice president of the education division at Key Impact Sales and Systems, told Politico he believes many food corporations want to keep the nutrition standards in place. A change in, say, sodium standards would require another retooling of products, and sodium tends to be high in frozen pizzas. Click on the featured post at eartheats.org to find links to these stories.
We post stories like these on Twitter all the time. Now all we need is your opinion. Join the community at Earth Eats. Mark Chilla, all the best to you for this week.
Thanks, Annie.
Following a devastating spring bird flu outbreak that wiped out egg layers and turkeys in the Midwest, authorities fear the worst this fall, a bigger outbreak, this time including meat chickens. Their fears are focused on the fall migration when wild birds fly south. But as Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, officials still don't know exactly what the biggest threats are.
The Moline family of Manson, Iowa, has been raising turkeys for 91 years. But for most of this summer, their barns were empty and quiet. In May, they found 90 dead birds. Lab tests confirmed they had flu. The surviving birds had to be killed and then the barns cleaned and disinfected. Brad Moline says he turned the fans back on and put these new baby turkeys in the barns on July 31st.
I had been excited since I was a kid. So we're getting back to, for lack of better words, back to normal.
His new normal includes fielding calls from other producers, some in the heart of southeastern chicken country, where they raise broilers, the chickens that become meat. His advice to them?
Look at biosecurity issues, but also have a plan, whether it's written in your office or on the side of a barn wall. Have a plan of what you're going to do in case this hits you, because it can. It's just that simple.
Biosecurity means disinfecting boots and tires that enter or leave the farm, requiring overalls and disposable booties, or showers, for anyone entering a barn. During the crisis, workers even wore protective suits with respirators. Federal officials say the virus came from wild birds, but blame lapses in biosecurity, among other factors, for it spreading so quickly. Some farmers even blame the wind. That said, nobody really knows exactly how it happened. In all, 48 million birds died from flu or were killed to contain it. Before a congressional panel in July, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack acknowledged mistakes were made.
We understand there are issues involving biosecurity, there are issues involving depopulation, there are issues involving disposal, there are issues involving indemnification, and the time for repopulation.
Licking some wounds after farmer criticism, USDA officials say they have a plan for this fall that could handle a worst-case scenario, twice as many infections. The department also hopes to stockpile vaccine. It won't prevent an outbreak, but could help contain one and make cleanup faster. Meanwhile, throughout the poultry industry, people are trying to make sense of bird flu.
He's still in the corn bin.
Cindy McCullough operates Blue Stem Organic Feed Mill in Webster City, Iowa. It's small. Customers drive up and get feed and go back to their farms. There aren't many trucks that visit a variety of poultry farms and her mill. That limited her exposure. Still, McCullough watched as the quarantine around infected sites came to within 7 miles of the mill.
And if we were within six, we would have had to have gone through the quarantine aspect and making sure that every truck is sprayed and that our biosecurity would have been brought up to a much, you know, we would have had to have limited access into the mill.
In Iowa, 77 quarantines were established, with the last of those only lifted in late August. McCullough's customers raise organic birds that can't live exclusively indoors. Like everybody, she's left with questions about the virus.
How it's spreading and why it was continuing to spread, because all of our birds are required to be outside. So the migratory bird aspect was a big question mark for us because we would have had the highest exposure.
Avian influenza naturally occurs in wild ducks and geese, who often are unaffected by it. But that fact doesn't explain how the virus got from them to the commercial flocks. Iowa State University wildlife ecologist Jim Edelman will soon be looking at sparrows and other small birds to see whether they can move the virus from migrating waterfowl to commercial poultry.
We are going to go out and sample a bunch of these types of wild birds, as well as some mammals and some insects. Look at these sort of non-traditional vectors that might play a role.
Edelman emphasizes that these are unlikely transmission routes. But in the absence of one solid explanation, many ideas are being pursued. Amid much anxiety and trepidation about the fall, when cooler temperatures also will increase risk. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Last week we started a conversation about farmers markets. What do these spaces look like, and how are they changing? Today, we bring in Jennifer Mita Robinson, author of the Farmer's Market book, Growing Food, Cultivating Community. She talks about how that apostrophe in farmers can tell us a lot.
But first, she lays out her definition.
Farmer's market is a widely used term, and it actually means a lot of things to a lot of different people. For me, a farmer's market is a place that people who grow food go and present their labor, the fruits of their labor, for review and evaluation and purchase by other people. But that's not always the way that farmers markets operate in the United States. Sometimes the food is bought by someone else and brought in. Sometimes there are cooperatives, so the person standing next to the food has not necessarily grown the food, but they know that person. They may be a family member or close by. And sometimes it's really just, you know, somebody has gone and made a big purchase from a farm far away. For example, watermelons might be purchased in Kentucky early in the season. And then they look to some people like they're being sold at a farmer's market, but I wouldn't call that a farmer's market. I would say I use the apostrophe after the S, so the market belongs to farmers collectively, and they're there to present their work.
Oh, now that's interesting. That apostrophe is sort of important.
I think it is.
Never thought about that. And your definition there requires the consumer to be a little bit aware and have some information about this.
Yeah. I think they aren't always. They're looking for that colorful place that they can buy fresh food that they think is going to be nutritious. And maybe there's fun going on there, too. There's activity. There are conversations. But people don't necessarily know what they're seeing or really even what they want, what makes one market better than another.
How does the word local fit into what we're talking about?
Yeah. Local is another term that's even more ambiguous and used in a lot of different ways and is now, like farmers markets, being co-opted by, you know, big business. And local has a lot of definitions. For the Bloomington market, local means anything grown within the state of Indiana. So you can, if you're willing to drive hours down from up north, you can sell at the Bloomington market, which is a local producer market. But you can't drive in a shorter distance from Illinois, for example, because it has to be grown within the state. So that's one definition of local. I think local is more nebulous in a good way than it's sometimes tried to be held to. I think it has to do with a people-to-people connection, to a people-to-environment connection, that it's about relationships within a system. And it's not necessarily a system that's just people close together, but it can be people far away that you're more connected to. We may be more connected to farmers in South America growing our coffee than we are to somebody growing soybeans for cows or pigs in Iowa. So local, I think it invites some thought, some thoughtfulness, some reevaluation.
The term farmer's market, I'm starting to think, might need some reevaluation too. You go to a supermarket and sometimes you'll see farmer's market above veggies.
Yeah.
On the Indiana University campus at the Union, we have a farmer's market where there are actually no farmers present. It's just a lot of local, grown in Indiana, local veggies for sale. What do you think about how this word's being used?
Yeah, I love that you can go to a big supermarket, you know, that's very squeaky clean and they've got a wooden crate and then maybe a, you know, a picture of some generic farmer. I mean, presumably it's a real person, whether it's connected to that produce or not, who knows. The farmer's market as a term has really slipped a bit, I suppose. It's a tricky matter because farmers need outlets for their produce. And every time they go to a market, it means that they're not there working their crops or their livestock. It also means that they don't get to be in the place that they're probably giving up a lot to be in. They want to be on the farm. The farm it's a very holistic lifestyle in the sense that their work extends throughout the day. It's a real commitment, and it's not something that everybody wants to do. And those people want to do it. I think if we as consumers value local food, then we need to support people who are willing to make that effort. And it's a very hard living to make. So they need places to sell. And they can't always leave the farm in the middle of the week. They can't always grow enough of one thing to even bother to take to a market. So a place where there aren't actually farmers present, but they are able to sell their food, might be a good thing for the farmers.
Jennifer Mita Robinson is a professor of practice at Indiana University's Department of Communication and Culture. Tell us what farmers markets mean to you. We've started a thread on Twitter, at Earth Eats. Coming up, acorn squash.
I like to use the local ones because they're not waxed, and you can eat the skin and everything. Otherwise, you may want to peel them if you get them from something other than a local farmer.
Fall is coming. Get ready. A couple recipes with Daniel Orr next. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. The end of the summer is state fair season across the Midwest, and that means lots of fried food, carnival rides, and livestock competitions. But at most fairs, there's also a whole lot more. If you missed the fair, fear not. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted sent us this audio postcard from his day at the state fair in Missouri.
I am Belinda Luke, and I'm from Columbia, Missouri.
My name is Tim Dollins, and I'm from Columbia, Missouri.
I wanted to see the hogs because the last time I was here, I saw the biggest hog I'd ever seen in my entire life.
And we went and looked at the calves over in the Coliseum as they're someone getting their pictures taken with their livestock, and then we also saw them getting ready for just a kind of huddling inside.
Clydesdales. Oh my gosh, I didn't realize how high they are.
God, 6 foot tall. Hello, 2,000 pounds.
My goodness.
Well worth the trip just for them.
I'm Alexandra Gross. I'm from Los Angeles, California, otherwise known as Sherman Oaks. We just entered here, so the far as I've gotten is into the llama barn, and they're very soft, and their noses are so cute. I didn't want one to spit at me, though.
Now go in. Walk into the middle of the circle. Here we go. And
Susie Griswold, and I am from Douglas County, Missouri. We're actually vendors here. The very first year, there was a, because I said we listened to all the kids' stuff, they had a really fun kids' person over there. His name was Babalu, and he was just good old-fashioned kids' fun. The one my kids remember the most is called the Wee Wee Dance. Yeah, the Wee Wee Dance, the Wee Wee Dance. I can't remember the last of it, but it's all about kids and what they do when they got to go.
Charlie Smith, and I swear I've done barn dances when I was younger. Retired and had to have something to do, so we started square dancing. It's good exercise, just all around good fun. We go all over, been all over the United States doing it. It's just a blast doing it. You meet some nice people and then you meet strange people, but that's all over. See your face,
swing your problem. I'm Felicia Dixon from Rolla, Missouri. State Fair is great. We love coming out here. Since how we're the only clogging group that gets invited to this particular day, it's awesome. I love the way everybody stands and watches and just embraces what we do.
It's the little tilt. I kill people with it. I'm totally kidding. I'm totally kidding. This ship right here goes all the way up in the air. I can stop them at the top and tilt the whole ship. The last spot, I had just, because I'm the brake person, so I just got done giving my brother Danny a brake who runs this ride. Well, a guy got off of the ride. He comes to me, he's like, do you have any paper towels? And I look up from my phone, and he's got puke from head to toe all over him. And it wasn't his puke. I thought they were really good. The young lady just has a sweet voice. Daniel has a nice voice that carries through everything. I love the mother's tin whistle. I hadn't heard that before. That was really, really cool.
Lots more from this reporter collective at harvestpublicmedia.org. First week of September. Can you believe it? Slowly but surely, fall goodies are popping up at farmers markets. We pulled a couple recipes today that we hope will get you excited for the cooler months. Chef Daniel Orr is behind the stove in two different kitchens. We start at his mom's house in Columbus, Indiana. Well, first, we're in the garden collecting ingredients for apple butter.
So I've got a few nice apples left here. Let me see if I can get a couple of them down.
And you're just batting them with a wooden rod.
Yeah, because I'm going to be cooking them right away. There we go.
There may be a couple worms in these. We'll see. You can trim most of that out. And as long as you've got that all cleaned up, then it's fine for apple butter or applesauce. You know, what's the question? What's worse than having a worm in your apple?
What's that?
Half a worm in your apple. Dun-dun-dun. All right, so we're going to just go through and we're going to trim these out, cut out the seeds. We're going to leave the skin on. The way I make apple butter is that I have I've got a really nice high-speed blender, so I can just puree the skin right into the apple butter. Okay, and so we'll take these over to the stove. And there's one other little trick that I do to get the apple butter started, so I'll show you how that's done. Put them in a can. In go the apples. Okay, we're going to add some lemon peel. So I'm just going to take, you could take a vegetable peeler or a paring knife, and I'm going to take about 5 strips down the lemon. This is going to give you that nice citrusy balance, which will be a nice counterbalance to the brown sugar we're going to put in here. And then I'm going to cut the lemon in half, squeeze in that juice, and I use my fingers kind of as a sieve to catch all those seeds. All right, so we're starting to come up to a little boil here. We're going to add some brown sugar. Add a pinch of salt, which is going to bring out all those great flavors. We're going to add some ginger, and we're going to add just a little bit of black pepper. Okay, and then to get it all going, just a little bit of cranberry juice in it. Whoa. That's going to give us a little color and a little bit of acidity. And so we're going to bring this to a boil, reduce the heat, and let it simmer down until it's nice and thick and all that liquid's reduced out of there.
Let that cook. And we'll check back on that in a bit. In his professional kitchen now at Farm Bloomington, he'll be at the fryer for this recipe, but you can use some oil in a pan, no problem. Homemade tempura. Here we go.
We're going to be using some local acorn squash, and they've got a nice sweet flavor. And I like to use the local ones because they're not waxed, and you can eat the skin and everything. Otherwise, you may want to peel them if you get them from something other than a local farmer. All right, so what you do is we're just going to cut it in half. It'll give a little bit of a struggle. And then what you do is you take a spoon, and we're going to scoop out the seeds. And then what we're going to slice these into very thin half moons. Thin so they cook very quickly, because tempura is a quick cooking method. All right, and now we're going to make the batter for them. So we got some good local brew from Upland Brewery. And to that, we're going to add cornstarch, regular white flour, pinch of salt, and a pinch of sugar. And it's important that all of your ingredients are nice and cold. That's going to help it adhere to the vegetables better. Okay, we're going to add one of our local eggs, and these are from pastured chickens. And then it's always a good idea to do a test batch. And so what we're going to do is just going to have our fryer oil heated to about 350 degrees. If it doesn't adhere very well, it means you need a little more flour. Okay, so back to the fryer we go. What you're trying to achieve is a very, very thin coating. So we're going to let these cook for about 2.5 minutes. One thing you must do is as soon as they're ready, serve them, because you don't want them to get soggy.
So you've got your plate with the paper towel ready to go?
Yeah, you always want to dump these out onto an absorbent piece of paper towel. And then we're going to put a little bit of salt on them. And you always want to season fried things as quickly as you can after they come out of the oil, so the salt will adhere to it. If they cool down a bit, your salt won't adhere to the vegetables.
You can just see the green skin through the batter. It's very pretty. EarthEats.org to learn how to do it yourself.
You can kind of hear it slurping and grunting at us.
And that is the apple butter.
And now is the time to put it into the blender. And again, if you have a really nice high-speed blender, it works the best. The great thing about the high-speed blender is that it will make it a very smooth, creamy product. Okay. And then, so once you have this done, you can just put it in some plastic containers and freeze it, and it will be there for you all winter long.
Be sure to label the containers.
That's my mom speaking.
Label the containers.
Label dates.
Mary Lou Orr, good tip there. A special thanks to her for letting her son and the Earth Eats crew take over her kitchen that day. EarthEats.org to see pictures and follow the recipe. Bunch of helpers for Earth Eats this week: Ayabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, and the wonderful reporters at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. So glad to have your company today. Till next time, I'm Annie Corrigan.